DCT Audio. The art of good listening.
My guest today, by his own admission, didn't enjoy school and left with very little academically. He joined the army, became a commando, served in Iraq, and later became a police dog handler. Certainly, he displayed the necessary grit and willpower to overcome difficult circumstances. But he wasn't happy within himself. He went on to project management and immersed himself into systems thinking. He is perhaps unique in that he has combined that thinking with personal well-being. He has recently published a 10-point well-being plan. We talk about that, and also the effects of the pandemic, lockdown, and the future impact of AI. Lee Mann, welcome to 33 Minutes. We last spoke in 2020, and the last 3 years have seen some dramatic events. A worldwide pandemic, society in lockdown, and now artificial intelligence. Some will say could be the downfall of the human race. It's left people bewildered, lost, and isolated. How have you managed during these turbulent times?
I made the decision at one point, after the initial, this is great, we're all on holiday, weather's great. And then I think it was the second lockdown where the weather was terrible, it was dark, couldn't leave the house. That became hard. And I think I put myself into a position where I made the decision of, I don't know how long this is going to be, but I'm going to come out of it in a better place and better prepared for what the world looks like then than I am now. I'm not going to wait for this to stop. I'm not going to pause my life just because things around me have been paused. I'm going to move forward, and I'm also going to prepare myself for what potentially might be waiting for me on the other side.
Well, that very nicely brings us into your blog that you've just written and published. And you've taken your life philosophy and broken it down into 10 steps. Why don't we go through them?
I think the first thing, just to be clear before we go into it for anyone listening, is this is not how I've always lived my life. This is a reflection on the things that have worked for me since I've essentially turned my life around. Step number one, use whatever fuel is available to you, but look to change to more healthy options when you can. We all know that if you're really angry, and that's what's driving you to work, or that's what's driving you to the gym, that's what's driving you to do some activity or whatever, we all know that's not good. It's not going to be good for you. You're angry. And I almost wrote a blog called Boxing Saved My Life and Systems Thinking Saved Me from Boxing. Probably at my lowest point, I was near on suicidal, and I picked myself up and went to a boxing gym. And I remember being stood there, skipping, just thinking no one around me knows or thinks anything of me. And that physical exertion and all that stuff was super good for me, definitely saved me. And I think it was when I started to understand systems thinking, I was able to reframe things a bit better and sort of say, well, what am I doing this for? Why am I doing it? Why is that rage still there? But that shouldn't discount the fact that the rage saved me. And if that's all you've got, use it, but use it in a positive way.
I mean, in certain ways, it's a distraction, isn't it, from perhaps the trauma you're going through. And it's also a vehicle to help you get away from that trauma. I know several former addicts with drugs and alcohol, and similar to yourself, they've actually said that their addiction saved them in the short term because it gave them a breathing space until they were ready to face the trauma. Well, the next step you mentioned was about climbing.
The climb is the destination. From a meta perspective, you're already out. What meta means is from a view above the situation, looking down. And from that view, you are already out. Even though you're technically not where you want to be, you're moving.
There's an old saying, isn't it? Climbing mountains. We're always climbing two mountains, aren't we? The one that's in front of us and the one that we're carrying.
For me, one of the real important things that I noticed when I started to turn things around, it took a long time for actually physically much to change in career. I think it probably took 4 years before anything changed career-wise. It took a long time before anything changed financial-wise. But the fact that I was making forward momentum in my life, I was developing myself, I was making progress, I was light years away from where I'd felt, even though technically to the outside world, nothing else has actually changed.
So let's go on to step three of your blog.
Continually work to increase your number of options. So there's a bit of systems thinking in the background there, which was a gentleman called Heinz von Forrester said pretty much exactly that. But I find that's worked for me personally in life. Instead of saying, I want to get there, and then you stay utterly focused, you may think that you're failing, but it's an external event that's affected you. Or you may just miss these amazing opportunities that could present themselves, A, because you didn't see them, or B, because you didn't put things in place that might make you ready for them when they arrive, because you were purely focused. Mm.
Now, your next point perplexed me a little bit. Step five is that you realize there is no summit, but the previous step said focus on the summit. So you've confused me there. Go on, explain that.
So remember when we said, if rage is all you've got, use it, but use it effectively. Summit's not a good thing either. And everyone listening probably will have done this. When I get, or when I am, I'll be so happy. What had made me happy was the progress towards...
to the journey. And the other thing, I suppose, is that you're imagining what that moment of happiness might look like for you when you reach it. The thought of that is making you happy, but once you reach it, it's now what?
And this is why so many super rich celebrities are miserable.
And there's some very poor podcasters that are quite miserable. So, number six.
Do not seek or expect happiness. That is a sure path to misery. Look for purpose, meaning, and worth. And I think it's knowing the right time to have that discussion with yourself. If you can get yourself to understand, actually, life's not about being happy. Life's about getting on, cracking on, and getting your way through it. And if you've got people that you care for, getting them through it as well. Yes. And helping them through and helping them get through their lives. And that is where a sense of pride and purpose comes from. And the best bit about it is if you do that along the way, you're going to have moments of pure joy, but they're not going to be constant. Number seven, reach down and help others, but only if they're willing.
That's a big nut to crack, isn't it?
It is. And in particular, if it's someone that you're close to or you care for. And essentially, if they're not ready, there's nothing you can do to make them ready. Logic isn't going to work. Motivational speeching isn't going to work if that person isn't ready. And that's different for every person, but you need to commit yourself that things are going to change.
Well, just going back to the other side of your point, why do you think it makes us happy helping other people?
I just don't think there's anything better you can do. In business, I've been fortunate enough to have management and senior management roles since I left the police. And they're hard because you're never facing the customer or the public. You don't get that hands-on instant feedback of value. I've always said, I feel really sorry for those senior managers that miss out on the opportunity to really get to know and develop their staff, because that is the best bit about being a manager. If you've got members of staff that want to grow and you can work with them, and then they ring you one day and say, I've just got this job, thank you for all your help. Why would you rob yourself of that? Mm.
The best sort of happiness is when you find your joy in other people's happiness.
I love that.
Tell me about number eight.
Continually assess and reframe. And I think this goes back to one of the points you raised. What did you actually set off for? You'll develop through this journey. If you're going through this journey and you're working, you will change, develop, and learn lots about yourself. From what you set your initial goal as, that vision of, I want to be rich, or whatever you did, on this journey, you'll change. And it's important to go, what am I actually doing this for? What did I actually want to be rich for? And then you have a conversation with yourself and say, really, what was I after? And now you might say to yourself as a more mature version, well, I've got financial freedom. I don't need to be rich for that. I can't go and buy Lamborghinis, but I'm happy living with my means. And I don't want to have no responsibilities. I've enjoyed this struggle and I want to continue. I want to have responsibilities in my life. So I'm going to reframe what I'm not going to get rid of it because I still need that vague direction, but I'm going to change it.
Number nine.
Look down, across, and sometimes up. Reflect on which is most useful to you at the time. Okay. So the person with no car wants a car. Person with the car wants the Ferrari. We've all seen the pictures. Then the person in the Ferrari wants a helicopter. They want the private jet. They want the space rocket. God knows what they'll want when they get a space rocket. The matter is, there's always going to be someone to look to be jealous of for something. So depending on where you're looking up and down from, depends on how that looks. So that's important to make clear. Each can offer you something, but it's be careful which one you pick. Don't always just look down and go, oh, I'm so lucky. You just, oh, well, I'm self-loathing. What a spoiled, self-loathing brat I am. And then you start to feel down. This isn't good for you. And where's the struggle here? Where's the motivation? Where's the forward momentum for you? So then you look up and you see these people that are miles ahead of you. And you can either be resentful or you can think, do I want what you want? Do I want the sacrifice that Elon, he hasn't got a life, has he? He doesn't go home. He sleeps in his factory. I know I don't want that. So I will never be jealous of Elon Musk because I would never have his life. I don't want it. And then you look across and you see your peer set. You say, who am I with? And these are the people that have got similar lives to me in this area. When you're doing that, you can try and be a bit systemic around it. So what if I blend in various things, lifestyle, finance, etc. What across that is the people that's doing the same? And that's great. But I'd always just reflect and say, could I be pushing myself a bit more than where I am?
So finally, number 10.
Excuses are for politics. Ways and means are for you and yours. Okay. There's a trend on many social media sites and across society as a wider whole of looking for a reason why you can't do something. I can't do that because I've not got a degree. That was personal to me. Told myself it for so long, held myself back. Everyone's got excuses. You look at anyone that you think is super successful, and I bet they've got a ton of excuses they can bring forward. You may come from a different family background to someone else. You may come from a different financial circumstances to someone else. You may come from a different demographic to someone else. And there is going to be unfairness within our societies. There always is. But what's most important is that you don't then turn that into an excuse for you. All you can do is find means and ways for yourself to move forward using what you have access to from where you are. And you can be happy and you can make progress that way. And if one of the ways you want to go, because you're such motivated, is to go into politics to change these things and that becomes your motivation, fantastic, go for it. But don't hold yourself back because there's problems in the world, because there always will be.
Before we move on to real world problems, I suppose, is why did you write the blog?
Two reasons, really. And if I'm honest, I had to do a bit of soul searching. First reason, you'll know this yourself because you've been through a similar journey. It consumes your mind a lot, thinking that other people are there. I would rather this blog only be read by one person that actually helps them. So it's going to fix all the problems, but it helps them and helps them on their journey to getting out of a bad place than it go viral and have loads of views. Number two, so I can sleep at night. There's a couple of reasons why it helps me sleep at night. I've got it out there, and if someone wants to use it, it's there. And it gets things out of my brain. It helps me structure thoughts in my brain. Blogging for me is really good for me at times. It's when I've got all this stuff in my head and it just allows me to structure it. And then having conversations with you like this really help.
Going on to real world problems now then. And as we said at the start, who would have thought the last time we spoke we'd go through a pandemic? What sort of effects do you think that's had on society as a whole and the individuals that make up that society?
It's a really difficult one on reflection because I think everyone found it hard, but it's probably the most divisive time I've ever lived through. And I'm not convinced that lesson's been learned. And that's hard. There was far too much football team social behavior, i.e. let's split this really complex issue into two sides. Which side are you on?
It was very polarizing, wasn't it?
This is one of the reasons I really enjoy speaking with you, Dave. It's an opportunity to have a conversation at this level. And things like COVID, you really need to sit back and be able to think critically and openly about multi-factors. And most people don't want to do that. They just want, well, which side do I pick? And that's the side I'm on. And I think when you're sort of in the bit of a gray, but some of that gray is not in the area of the person who's picked a side, you almost can't talk about it. And at the time, it was the only thing that anyone was talking about because nothing else was happening because we were all locked in our houses. It became quite isolating. And I think a lot of people suffered from that.
And opinions as well. I mean, you and I could have different opinions. We're still friends. We seem to have got to the point where, well, I disagree with you. I can't be your friend anymore.
And that was supported by celebrities coming out and saying, I've removed people from it. It was Jennifer Aniston. People had different views to her on part of COVID. So she said, I've just had to remove them from my lives. Let's be adults and have open conversations about things. And understand that we may never actually come to an agreement, but we can at least come to a point where we understand each other's view.
I think the pandemic brought out the worst in everybody. You and I are too young to have lived through the Second World War. People go over the community spirit and how everybody got together. It wasn't as rosy as we like to think it was. There was a lot of looting. There was a lot of criminality. Poverty certainly played a part in the pandemic and how it isolated and polarized people. You know, I live in a fairly nice house with a big garden, and I thought, it's not too bad for me. Life hasn't really changed that much. But then I thought about the single mother with four kids, living on the 30th floor of a block of flats, and they're not allowed out. That is just a pressure cooker.
And you think about the victim of constant domestic abuse, is now locked in a house with that abuser.
And the other thing I noticed was that it brought out this not on my doorstep attitude. If the problem doesn't affect me directly, I'm not interested. And unfortunately, that seems to be an attitude now that's taken forward. And I'm not sure that attitude was there before the pandemic or whether the pandemic has just made the attitude bigger. I don't know.
Did it happen because society was heading that way anyway? And has it sped it up? Have we learned from it? I would say I don't feel that we have learned from it as a society.
Now, some of the practical downsides of lockdown, which we are still experiencing today, is working from home. And we seem to have barriers in place now. So why hasn't all that infrastructure returned to where it was?
Definitely don't have the answer. I work from home most of the time. I think building on your point is working from home, we did the experiment in terms of we went from you have to be in the office. And video conferencing was almost a bit of only the cool kids are doing that. And will it really work? The NHS, for instance, video appointments. Could they work? Where would they fit? And then instead of gradually introducing it over time, which could have took 10, 15 years, overnight. And bear in mind that none of that would have happened if the technology hadn't just arrived. But if it had happened like 10, 15 years before, we'd have all just been doing our jobs, going to work as normal, wearing a mask and some gloves. But just because the technology arrived and we went full shebang. And then it's what lessons have we learned from that? What did work? What didn't work? But if you are at home, you need to be able to do the job at home, can't you? It can't be that I'm working at home, so therefore I can't do this part of my job and no one else is picking it up. That was pandemic. We can put some things down while we go through this. We're not there now. The service needs to stand up. If there's ways that we can make that business or part of the business run with a bit more flexibility, more power to it.
It seems to me that everything that's happening at the moment, which is in inverted brackets progress, seems to be disconnecting people from each other. Not working in an office is bad for your mental health because you're not having that connection with your work colleagues. You know, I'll always do an interview eye to eye.
You're absolutely right on that. And I think this experience will be very different because we'll have a chat afterwards. And we had a good chat and you met my dog and walked around my house when you arrived. If we'd have just logged in, none of that. So, and that's the same with meetings, really. You're walking, you meet someone, you have a bit of light chat, you're waiting for the last person to come in, everyone's. And you know what? If it's a bit intense, you can look off to the left, look off to the right, whereas you just glared at a screen looking at yourself. It's
formulaic, isn't it, online?
Yeah, it's harder, but it has got a place. It's very efficient. So when at my previous role, when I went to London, so I had to be there one week a month on site, the other time I was remote. I would block out my diary that week. I would have no meetings and I would just wander around the building, talking to people, sitting down, random conversations, go for walks with my team, make sure each of my managers, I'd go for a walk with them and just say, and for me, that was okay. I can do the transactional stuff more efficiently remotely, but when I'm in the office, the real value is building the connection, going down and just sitting down in the operation and seeing what's actually happening, what actually happens. That was the value. And it allowed me to prioritize that because I think what happens sometimes with the open office is that people think, oh, well, we put everyone in a big open office and they'll all collaborate. Most of the evidence now points to the fact that an open office actually does exactly the opposite. It doesn't drive efficiency because everyone actually busies themselves with looking busy rather than actually delivering anything and don't talk to each other.
Well, that nicely brings us on to a topic that I know you wanted to talk about, and that's artificial intelligence. Big in the news at the moment. Where's it all going to end is the open-ended question. And the obvious example is the Terminator film, Skynet, a computer that becomes software. Where do you think we are with AI?
It's a really interesting one, because for a long time, the mantra I had was there's not really any such thing as artificial intelligence, it's just machine learning, i.e. it's like almost calculator type. It compounds tree structure algorithms over time that get more and more complex, but there's not an actual intelligence. For a long time, that's my view. Whereas now you've got some of the big dogs coming out. So Elon Musk, you've got the guy from Google coming out and saying this is a massive problem.
Why do you think it's suddenly become a problem? It's not like artificial intelligence has just emerged out of nothing. They've been developing it and refining it for years.
So I don't know if they're nervous about how it could affect their industry and there's a selfish point of view, or if they're nervous of what they could do. It's really interesting to note, if I try and link this to COVID, one of the things that I struggled with when people talked about the UK and generally everywhere else's reaction to COVID, whether the action they took you agree with or not, I hope that you can still agree with the point I'm trying to make. There's a large criticism that the UK government acted too late. And if they'd have acted sooner, X, Y, and Z. Do you understand what a paradigm shift is? Yeah. Paradigm is a perceived as is state. The world is this. The world is that you can go outside in a free country. That's a paradigm that we are in. And up until that point, it never really changed within anyone's conceivable lifetime. Mm. And have you seen the movie Flight with Tom Hanks, where he lands the plane in the river in New York?
Oh, yes. Captain Sutley.
And they do a simulation, don't they? And each time, the simulator would have got it back to the airport.
Yes.
Every time, it would have gone back to the airport. And then they run. Why did you do that? Because we've simulated and it's this. It feels the same thing a lot to me as when people talk about how they reacted. I'm not defending or attacking either way. I will keep my views on that to myself. But what is missing from that view is you're looking back after the paradigm shift was shifted.
You haven't included the human factor.
Yeah, we don't tell people to stay in the houses. We don't shut industries. It's not even that they were saying that or even thinking that. It was the paradigm was that embedded that that's not even a thought process you would have. You wouldn't have to tell yourself you're not going to shut a business because the paradigm is that's not a thing. So the question to me on this is, people are raising flags. Will we look back and say, we should have done something about it sooner, we were warned earlier, and now we're just in a paradigm, whereas what we would do still isn't a thing? That's the crossover I see between the two at the moment. I think there's going to be huge benefits to how we do things through AI. The more and more we remove that factory repetitive tasks and the looking for details and data that is there by humans, we remove humans away from non-purposeful work, which means that they can be involved in more work that involves emotion and things that humans are good at, which you'd like to think would improve well-being. So there's lots of benefits there. The interesting part to me is, will that just be that they were nervous and wanted proper regulation and everything is fine? Or will we look back and go, as we done with COVID, we were warned and we didn't act and completely bypass the fact that the significant human paradigm shift that it takes?
We are both of an age where we lived through the digital revolution, didn't it? You know, just as the industrial revolution transformed the lives of people. And the analogy I sort of bring is AI is now the equivalent of splitting the atom as part of the Industrial Revolution process. I wonder if could they have foreseen the potential benefits and drawbacks to that process? Could they have foreseen that actually we could use this as a bomb, or we could use this to provide limitless power? I don't know at that particular point when they did actually manage to split the atom, whether they were thinking that far ahead. And similarly with the AI, is it going to be a genie that's now out of the bottle?
I can't remember whose phrase it is, but it's just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Well, I think the other thing, and the internet, when it first came out, was no real big deal, was it? And for me, what changed the internet is how we access it. And it's when the invention of the smartphone came out, and that revolutionized how we access the internet. And that's when the internet exploded. So I'm just wondering, with AI now, have we got the vehicle yet to fully exploit that technology that will then make AI a part of our lives, just as smartphones and the internet have become?
through your smartphone, you've got access to pretty much all recorded human recorded information at your hand, but you still have to go in and find it. Whereas with the potential of AI is to bring that to you with insight. And that's really powerful for business, powerful for medicine, for research. The potential for that is amazing. What's important is user intent.
I mentioned about mobile phones, didn't I, how we access the internet. And if we went back 200 years and we were sat in our front of the coal fire in our Victorian house and we'd be talking to the technology today, we'd thinking, you're just, nah, what are you talking about? You're mad. But I honestly think with this AI business and the danger of it is that it becomes self-aware. But our human psyche, our thought process, will become interlinked with AI. So there'll be that human element. I'm not saying we're walking around like robots, but can you imagine a human brain, core of your being and how you feel and how your thought processes tapped into AI? That's a scary thought.
Thanks for that. Won't sleep tonight.
It's almost unbelievable to think that that could happen. But as I say, if we'd sat down 200 years ago and predicted what we are now doing, you would never have countenanced the idea.
I think the leap in like the last 50 years is more significant than the millennia prior to it.
And I think it's just as important how we access that technology as just is the technology itself.
And I think it's compounding. I think what you're seeing is compounding. There's key moments that have slow burn, a bit like what I'm talking around personal life, is you start small, create fire, get tools. And these things, hundreds and thousands and hundreds of thousands of millions of years, slowly burn. And then you reach a tipping point where it starts to, the wheel starts to spin on its own and it spins faster and faster and faster. And that's that positive or negative compounding. And it feels like technology-wise, we're in the same places. It's just getting faster because it's self-reinforcing itself. The technology is constantly allowing for the next leap of technology and it's speeding up.
Well, I suppose finally, and from your point of view and from a systems thinking point of view, and I know you hate that phrase and I hate it because the whole point of systems thinking that there is no system. And you mentioned technology and now it's compounding upon itself and it's getting that wheel spinning faster. Will there always be a baseline of human need or human ingenuity? Whereas if we lost everything, we would just reset.
It's a tough one to answer. I was talking about that with a group of people I know that are all interested in this type of thing and well-educated. I always like to go for them because I learn so much from the conversation. But there's two things. There's two types of system that you could talk about with a feedback loop, a closed system and an open system. So a closed system just has its information feedback that it regulates itself through, but only from within the information that's held within the system. So input, output. And it's as if nothing in the environment can influence it. So Woolworths is a prime example of what a system being closed or Blockbuster, eventually it dies out because it comes irrelevant to the changing environment. An open system is constantly outside, reframing itself, bringing in new information, challenging its previous design, developing itself and merging. It'd be scary if and when I'm proven wrong, but right now, computers and therefore AI are by their very design a closed system because they can only access the information that is already there. It's a massive closed system. It's all the information, but it's closed to only what's there. So the experiment with something like ChatGPT, where now insight, not just access to data, but insight is at the fingertips.
You can pass the bar exam now with the latest version.
Yeah, which I love because I hate a test of intelligence being, have you managed to digest and then regurgitate information? That's memory. That doesn't encompass, and it's not the best of human intelligence. And machines can now do that for us. So I hope that pushes us into tests that test more useful types of human intelligence. So of course, I'm all about that. But you're putting insight in the hands of everyone from masses of information. What's the end game when you just constantly, over time, repeatedly recycle the same information? And that's the thing I found interesting.
The only analogy I can think of there's a guy called Sadhguru, who's a guru, mystic, whatever you want to call him. He was describing the difference between humans and animals. And animals have two points, the born and the die. And within those two points, they're programmed to do what they do. Humans, between the point of birth and death, can decide what they want to do, where the animal doesn't have that choice. And I suppose it's similar to what you were saying about a computer. Does it have a choice on the decisions it makes, or is it just bound by its own infrastructure, if you will, and the way its circuits work?
It will be interesting to see, but with the compounding, I don't think we're far away from finding out.
Well, like I say, you tap the power of a human brain into the AI technology, or think of it another way. Imagine AI unlocking the power of the human brain. They say we only use 1-2% of our power, and you've got autistic people who just use their brain in a different way, people that almost all sorts of things. That's a scary thought.
And how does that happen? Because going back to the point, you process through the same information into everyone, and it will start to drive the same type of behavior. As that happens and then happens again, and more behavior, and then if that algorithm starts to refine itself based off that reaction, it becomes more and more narrow. And it feels like, well, what's the end game there? Because there's only what you've got in. And if it's influencing the outside in, and the outside in is influencing the inside out, in a closed system, does that not just get narrower and narrower and narrower? And I don't know.
No.
I'm not an AI expert, but that was the view I took at it from a systems view.
And this comes down to choice, doesn't it? Human choice. If you could link somebody, a person's brain, into AI who's malevolent, opposed to somebody that wants to do good in the world, two outcomes are very, very different.
Yep. And that's the second thing that's going to stop me sleeping tonight.
Sorry about that. it's been an absolute pleasure. It's always a joy to speak to you, Liam, and we could talk for hours. But for now, thank you very much.
No, thanks. Thanks for coming round. It's really great to talk. I've always enjoy your work, and I always enjoy talking with you. So let's do it again.